KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. So let's see what we got in store for our weather this weekend. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your Wasatch Back forecast for your Friday. And as we move into the upcoming weekend, we're going to be starting things off with partly cloudy skies with a chance of some scattered showers and maybe even a couple of rumbles of thunder out there as we go throughout the afternoon. Again, it's going to be isolated to scattered in nature, but the rain chance will be there for us. In Park City, we'll see our high temperatures climbing into the lower 80s today with the extra clouds and some scattered showers. The Heber Valley looking at high temperatures climbing into the upper 80s for highs with partly cloudy skies out there and that chance of those isolated to scattered showers developing. As we go into your Saturday, we'll call it partly cloudy skies. Still a chance of an isolated shower, storm or two, but the overall rain chance will be on the decrease as we go into the weekend. High temperatures in Park City will be into the low 80s. We'll still be in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. So no need to cancel your outdoor plans as we move into the weekend as the rain chance will be a little lower than our Friday going into our Saturday. So very isolated in nature. Now, as we go into your Sunday, we're dry out there. So that high pressure ridge takes over. That's going to mean dry and warming conditions here. So the second half of your weekend will feature lots of sunshine with high temperatures in the low to mid 80s in Park City. And we'll see those highs into the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. As we get ready to kick off the new week on Monday, we've got high pressure overhead, so lots of sunshine. High temperatures will be in the mid-80s in Park City. We'll see those highs around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. And then we start to warm it back up in a big way as we go into your Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week. Lots of sunshine expected each and every afternoon with high pressure in control. And high temperatures will be into the upper 80s in Park City on your Tuesday and Wednesday. We'll be in the low 90s by Thursday. And for the Heber Valley, we'll see those highs going from the low 90s to the mid to upper 90s as we go throughout much of next week. So the heat will return after a brief break this weekend. Let's look at your latest forecast at the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, we're speaking with Park City High School football coach Josh Monzingo as they kick off their season against Wasatch tonight. Then Mayor Nan Worrell will stop by to recap last night's city council meeting. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with bankruptcy expert Tom Beckett about the Wahali bankruptcy. As crews battle the growing Beulah fire in the Uinta Mountains, another sparked mere miles away during a lightning storm. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the Haystack fire is expected to remain small.
Fire officials discovered the half-acre haystack fire in trees just south of Washington Lake Wednesday afternoon. Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest spokesperson KJ Pollock says it's been smoldering since a lightning strike July 30th.
They hold over that long. It did, I guess, you know, kind of when the winds came up and it kind of popped up.
Air and ground crews responded and began to extinguish it Wednesday. It had not grown as of Thursday. The Beulah fire east of Christmas Meadows, meanwhile, remained 0% contained Thursday, 1 week after it was first reported. It's just over 4,300 acres, with 554 firefighters responding via air and ground. They're focusing on protecting structures in the Christmas Meadows cabin area and the Hinckley Boy Scout camp. As of Thursday, road and backcountry closures remain in place between Christmas Meadows, North Slope Road, East Fork Blacks Fork Road, and nearly to the Highline Trail. Parts of the popular trail pass into the closure area, and the road accessing it is also closed. North Slope Road itself is closed. While rain and cooler temperatures from thunderstorms forecasted for this week may aid firefighting efforts, officials say storm systems also bring the chance of additional lightning and high winds. The cause of the Beulah fire is under investigation. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Military Installation Development Authority, or MIDA, added more land to its Wasatch County projects. Thursday, KPCW's Grace Dorfler has this update.
MIDA, the state agency founded to serve veterans and military members, expanded its projects in Wasatch County by 22 acres during its board meeting August 14th. The projects are known collectively as the Military Recreation Facility Project Area. The new land surrounds Deer Valley Resort's Jordanelle Express Gondola and is owned by Deer Crest. MIDA spokesperson Kristen Kenny-Williams said MIDA will begin a master planning process for the parcels to be developed, but offered no additional details. The Wasatch County project area began with 40 acres along US 40 in 2012 and has grown exponentially, largely thanks to thousands of acres owned by Deer Valley East Village developer Extel. MIDA now oversees billions of dollars worth of development there, including East Village and the Sky Ridge development. MIDA is governed by a board of appointed, not elected officials. It was founded in part to create new military recreation opportunities after the closure of a 7-room military lodge near Snow Basin in the 1990s. It replaced that lodge with the Grand Hyatt Deer Valley, where out of nearly 400 rooms, 100 are set aside for the military to book at discounted rates based on rank. MIDA Executive Director Paul Morris said Thursday, active duty and retired service members staying at the hotel are also eligible for discounted Deer Valley ski lift tickets. Ticket prices are likewise tiered by rank. Morris said he became concerned that military guests staying at the hotel might not be able to afford the resort's lift tickets. A Saturday skiing at Deer Valley costs $300 per adult for much of the winter.
But we got concerned that if you're a military person at this nice discount, staying in this beautiful hotel, can you ski? Can you afford to ski? Oh, one of their officials said, that will be so embarrassing.
Morris said he asked the resort's chief operating officer, Todd Bennett, to come up with a discount. Eligible military members can purchase day passes for $89 to $129, depending on their seniority. Williams, the MIDA spokesperson, said the discounts were also in place for the 2024-25 winter season. Only service members staying in military rooms at the Grand Hyatt are eligible. Deer Valley separately offers military discounts. A military ski pass on a typical winter Saturday costs about $250. Deer Valley Resort is a financial supporter of KBCW. Grace Dorfler, KBCW News.
The Park City Miners football team opens their season tonight against the Wasatch Wasps. Here to preview the season is Coach Josh Monsinga. Good morning, Josh. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So before we get to tonight's game, let's talk a little bit about what's gone on over the last few weeks. What is the routine you follow to get this team ready?
Yeah, I mean, the offseason's a long grind, as much as the season's a grind. There's a lot of work that goes in the weight room, a lot of work that goes in, you know, field work, getting some speed, working on just our overall footwork and skills, you know, things you can do without pads on that you're allowed during the summertime. Also, you have team camp time where you do get allowed to have some pads for a little bit of time, and we go to Colorado. We have a little bit of fun with that, and Colorado Mesa hosts a nice camp, and college coaches get to watch our guys, and our guys get to show off a little bit and play some teams from Colorado or scrimmage some teams from Colorado, which is a ton of fun, and we find out who we are a little bit and what we got to work on all summer long. So
when do you start with the preseason program in terms of like organized practices?
Organized, we would start with that team camp, which is right after school gets out, right?
Okay.
In June.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it's not organized per se. It's more of what we call it 7-on-7 practices because we're just in shorts and t-shirts. But we do as much as we can with like I said, some skills and some drill work with a lot of guys. This is Park City, so a lot of people are vacationing as well. And we will respect that family time as well, but also get some work in. And then really and truly, once we get back to it, it's that time we start at the end of July where we put the pads back on and it's for real. So we've been doing that for the last 3 weeks.
Okay. And how many players are you carrying on the squad this year?
Right now, I think we're sitting at about 85, 86.
Is that normally where you want to be?
Yeah. I mean, where you've been as high as 94 in the past. That's a lot of guys sometimes for a JV varsity to try and get in. But, you know, the more the merrier. It's a sport that takes a toll physically. So depth is something we would love to develop more of. And we welcome the participation by as many as we can get.
Well, you certainly had a successful season last year, although it didn't quite end up the way you wanted it to. I think the last time you were here was right before that game.
Yeah.
But the thing about high school football is that your cast turns over substantially every year. You're always starting over to some extent. Let's talk a little bit about that kind of turnover issue. What are some of the biggest holes left by last year's graduation? And then we'll talk about how to fill them.
Sure, yeah. We lost a lot on offense. We returned more on defense this year. So we're very senior heavy on defense. And offensively, you know, losing your starting quarterback, that's a big deal. Losing the majority of your offensive line is obviously an even bigger deal, in my opinion. It starts up front. But we bring back a tremendous amount of talent. We had a lot of guys that played. They might not have been quote-unquote starters, but they played meaningful varsity minutes, and they're ready to show off that it's their turn to be the starter this year. Very excited about our guys on offense. I think we're fast. We're not huge, but we are fast. They're going to have to catch us.
Okay, so who's going to be the new quarterback?
Cole Morgan won the battle. It was a great battle all summer long. Him and a junior who had moved in a tremendous battle went forth, and it just was squeaked out by Cole. He did a good job. He's ready to go. He's been in the program for a while.
Is he a senior?
He is. So okay. He knows what to expect. You know, he's someone that understands what I'm looking for in a quarterback, and is just getting his chance to go show up.
And what's the biggest hole on the other side of the ball, on the defensive side, that you've had to fill?
Probably working some of the D-line. We lost more D-line than we lost anything else, but the great thing is we were really deep there. We play 6 to 7, sometimes 8 guys every game. We rotate a lot. It's almost like a hockey line shift on the D-line, which I think minimizes some of that when you lose your entire starting 3, because we only have 3 of them. Well, but the other guys played a ton, and they're pretty scary as well.
Any special teams observations that you can make about, did you lose a kicker or anything like that?
No, we bring back our kicker. Tanner Pidwell is going to be tremendous for us, one of the best in the state. He's a D1 kicker. We're very blessed to have him. He works his own craft to no end. He has a big leg. He's accurate. The moment's not too big for him. He's calm. He's cool. He's everything you could ask for. And then we're actually pretty deep at kicker. We have a few other young guys that are working their way up. So, man, that's turned around in the past 5 years or so. Thank God for the soccer team and guys self-recruiting themselves. That's kind of what happens. One gets success. We started with one that got to D1 during the COVID era there, and he just told the next one, well, hey, come on in. You can make it to kick in college too. And they've kind of all just self-fed this process. It's been great.
Are there any sort of players that we didn't hear a lot about last year that you would expect to get some attention this year? Who do you think might have a breakout year?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question. I mean, he was a big-time player for us last year. I don't know that everybody knew who he was a little bit, but Nico Morgan right now at safety for us is also going to play a little bit of a dual role on the offensive side as well. He's someone that's kind of electric, especially if he gets the ball in his hands. I'm excited to pull him on my side just a little bit, but, you know, him patrolling that back end of the defense is pretty special. He's going to do some great things for us. We have a D lineman who I'm kind of excited about as well, that I definitely, no one knows the line. So Jack Rayner right now is kind of a terror off the edge. He's a pain in the mind behind every time at practice. I'm like, what the heck? How did he get here? Oh, my goodness. I mean, scheme is part of it, but he's also just he has a high motor, great kid, hard work ethic, and just plays the game the right way.
Okay. You mentioned that there was a kicker that made it into the D1. Talk to us a little bit about your relationship with the players who have those kinds of ambitions and how the recruiting process works, and where do you fit in it?
Yeah, the D1 recruiting process is nuts, especially with NIL now. It's just a whole, I mean, it's a business. It's a multi-billion-dollar business, and to think otherwise is kind of crazy. But I don't think sometimes when the kids first get into it, they don't realize that. They see the romantic side of getting wanted, getting recruited, getting shouted out on social media. And then they realize, okay, wait a minute, I actually have to kind of self-market myself. So we have a lot of those talks. We talk about getting on Twitter because that's where college coaches go. It's not Instagram. It's not Facebook. It's not wherever you want to be. It's Twitter or X now. And so we talk about how to get on there, create a profile. Do it the right way. You're not on there for social reasons. You're on there to kind of almost, like I said, self-market yourself, get yourself out there, get your highlights out there, network with coaches, follow them, get them to follow you back, message back and forth. So it's probably a good life skill, really and truly, learn how to develop your network and work that network and try to climb to where you want to get to in life, which is really what football's all about.
How many of your players will actually engage in that process and at least try to test the waters of potential college players?
The majority that have aspirations of playing at the next level will do it. Because they know how important it is. Mm-hmm. At first, I had to really talk some kids into it, and then parents, allowing them to do it. And that was fair. I understood that. Trust me. I didn't want to be on social media for the longest time, but when I realized the value of it in talking to coaches, I'm like, okay, I got to do this. And that's really what I use it for. But otherwise, you know, once the kids realize the success of it, they talk to each other.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, you got to do this. Like, here's how you do it. And like, here's what worked for me. And so they help each other a lot.
And again, about how many players do you think will seek to play into the college ranks?
We usually have anywhere between 8 and 12 every year that are going to try to get there between D1 to D3. Mm-hmm. You know, and as I tell them, this is a vehicle for you to get somewhere to a college. Maybe you wouldn't have gotten to otherwise. Use your sport. Use this connection to get somewhere that's going to elevate your academics and your future in life.
Now, you're playing against the Wasps. This has become something of an annual tradition for the opener, hasn't it?
It is. Yeah, I think we were just talking about this, I think like 6-7 years now. It's been a while, but we brought it back a few years ago. It wasn't a thing when I first took over. It had kind of gone away and gotten lost for a bit. And I had Coach Coburn was talking some smack to me at one of our 7-on-7s about, hey, you guys won't play us. I'm like, that's not true. You're never on our schedule. He says, well, it used to be. And, you know, we went back and forth. I said, great. Well, next year. So ever since then. We've been back on.
It's home and home every other year.
It's home and home. We just keep it rolling. It doesn't come off, and we just keep back and forth.
And on a night like this, given how close Wasatch is, I imagine we're going to see a pretty full stadium.
I hope so. Absolutely. Yeah, it's always weird before school starts because, you know, we don't start till Monday. So some people push that envelope of obviously being out of town until the last second. You know, since we start Monday, sometimes we start the next week on a Wednesday or a Thursday. So people will push that, you know, this weekend. I think most will be back in town. So there's a lot of enthusiasm generated right now. And obviously, I love this old school rivalry of two small towns really getting after it. If you want to call Wasatch a small town, school's huge, but that's okay. It is fun. The historic rivalry back and forth is amazing, and it's something I cherish.
And tell us a little bit about what we can expect from this year's Wasps team. I assume you've scouted them to the extent, again, They're going to have a lot of player turnover too, so you
absolutely
can't really. It's not really like you've got valid film on them because it's all different.
Yeah, the first game is always kind of a mystery. We walk in like, okay, we think we know what they're doing, but honestly, someone's got a wrinkle or completely decided to change offense or defense. This year, they have another coaching change again this year. So last year, we figured out what they were going to do, thinking, okay, next year we'll have an idea. Brand new staff again, brand new coordinators. Okay, so now what are we really going to see? Honestly, it's kind of a giant mystery. So we're going to go based on our best ideas or guesses of you know, who got the job of what we think they're going to do. Truthfully, I think they have more of an idea of what we're going to do because we do have existing film. So they have probably the advantage in that. But you know what? We're just going to coach our tails off, and our kids are going to play their behinds off, and we're just going to go out there and compete and have a great time.
Now, tonight's game, like every game this season for the Park City Miners, will be broadcast here on KPCW. I want you to speculate with me. Whose name on the Wasatch Wasps will Pete be saying the most tonight? Who's going to stand out from their team?
Boy, that's a good question. I honestly can't tell you for sure. I believe their quarterback's going to give us a little bit of trouble. But I think that our defense is going to give him more trouble, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But he can run. He can move. He can boogie. He can scoot. there's been a decent amount of turnover from what I've gathered. So
okay, you don't even know, do you?
I don't, because it's going in that first game, and who's really on the roster. Rosters aren't always updated like they should be online, and then, you know, there's probably some gamesmanship. I'm not going to lie
about
that. I didn't say who our quarterback was, and you know, a week ago in an interview with somebody else, and I don't know. We're getting there. But honestly, we're down there. We're like, we know kind of a couple players, but to be honest with you, like I said, this that first game, there's a lot of mystery that goes into this, and there's a lot of adjustment on the fly on the field. You just kind of, which I think is actually kind of fun, but it's also kind of nerve wracking just a little bit.
It's got to be pretty intense on the sideline trying to make those observations. Do you have a coach up in the sky as well?
Yeah, we do. We have one for offense, one for defense, and a couple of spotters are looking for different things.
Looking for different things, so you can change things up.
Absolutely.
On the fly.
You know, they each have their own little role. Looking, you know, someone's looking at the line, just only the line. One of my line coaches is just solely focused on what's going on in the box, so I can be looking maybe outside at the outside where we're throwing and where we're running outside trying to get around the corner. And I got one of my receiver coaches looking on the backside, looking for some of the home runs. And everybody has a job and has a role. It's not one person. It's not just me calling the plays out there. It's a collective, and we're better together, which is going to be fun to watch, that we can put it all our talents and put them in one place.
Now, perhaps the oldest cliche in sports is we play them one at a time. But having said that, as you're looking at the schedule, what are some of the other games this season that you think might be particularly intriguing matchups?
Yeah, holy moly. I've been joking. There's a psycho who made a schedule for us, and he happens to be talking right now. Our first five games are not region games, and I went kind of nuts. Wasatch, we obviously are going to start with every year, so that was an easy one. But then I just looked for the best competition we could find this year, and I think we found it. We're going to have Ridgeline next weekend, who is predicted by, I think, anybody that in the world to win 4A. Mm-hmm. They're going to come down and play us down here, and then we're going to go on the road for three tremendous games. We're going to play Olympus at Olympus. We're going to play Morgan at Morgan, who's just kind of slaughtered 3A, and to be honest with you, beat up on some of the top 4A teams last year, and some people believe they would have won it as well. And we're going to finish with the former 5A state champion from last year, Bountiful, on their field. So truthfully, it's going to be a gauntlet, but man, the competition it's going to be like playoffs every week, which we're excited about. You know, we want to compete. That's what it's all about. We don't get better by just getting by or taking it easy. We get better by challenging ourselves and learning and growing from those opportunities.
And once again, we will broadcast every Miners game, home and away. Pete Gilwald is back in the booth for, gosh, I don't know how many years. We'll be there every week, and we're looking forward to the season with you. Josh, anything else you want to add before we go?
No, go Miners.
Go Miners. Coach Josh Monsingo of the Park City Miners, who kick off their game against Wasatch tonight at 7 o'clock at Dozier Field. Be there. We'll be or listen on KPCW. Oakley City has approved a property tax revenue increase to cover rising infrastructure costs. KPCW's Christine Weller reports.
The Oakley City Council approved an almost 5.4% property tax revenue increase Tuesday during a Truth in Taxation public hearing. For a $965,000 residence, property taxes would increase from about $504 to $530, or about $27 per year. Taxes on a $965,000 business would increase from about $916 to $965, which is over $49 per year. The additional property tax revenue gives Oakley an additional $23,700 per year, or over $35,000 as new homes and buildings are built. Councilmember Kelly Kimber said the funding generated from the tax increase will go toward infrastructure needs like fixing roads and improving aging buildings.
We do have an aging infrastructure. We've got things going on that need to be taken care of, and this looks to me like it's a small increase to take care of some pretty big problems.
Steve Wilmoth was the only council member to vote no on the increase.
I agree with everybody, but, you know, in the last little bit, I just feel like we've been taxed to death. And for the amount, I would sooner just give everybody relief for some time.
Councilmember Tom Smart, on the other hand, said he would rather increase property taxes incrementally rather than have to increase them a lot down the road. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Last night, the Park City Council held its regular meeting. Here with a debrief is Mayor Nan Worrell. Morning, Nan. Thanks
Good
for being
morning.
Here. Thanks for being here. Lots of discussion on 248, which seems to come up a lot. Let's first talk generally about what was the agenda item and what was accomplished.
The agenda item was recreate 248. It's been an ongoing project, and last December, the council met with staff in our regular meeting and kind of narrowed down what it was that we wanted to accomplish, you know, what's kind of the vision for 248. And then we came up with a staff with some screening criteria to evaluate different modes of transportation, you know, and several things have been eliminated, like a one-way loop throughout town that you'd come in and you could only turn left or you could only turn right or whatever and go in a loop.
That was a creative idea. I'm not sure how it would have worked. But
yeah, okay. I think it would have... Once we got used to it, I think it
might work.
Great, but yeah. Very confusing to start with. Things like, do we want to do aerial transit over 248? Do we want to widen the road? You know, so several things were eliminated, and it kind of came down to one of the things was, should we use the rail trail as a transportation corridor and put either light rail on it or some transit on that to alleviate the traffic on 248. And I have to tell you, one of the things I love about this town is how engaged and passionate our residents are. And the Prospector residents primarily, many others as well, but came out in force. And there was one community meeting, and then just last week at Tanatoli's suggestion, we had another kind of open house in Prospector Park with the staff talking about the project. A couple council members were there, and between 80 and 100 people came out and said, absolutely not, leave it alone. And the staff also did a survey, and 98% of the people said, do not touch the rail trail. Don't put anything on it. Don't put anything over it like a monorail. Don't put a subway underneath it, a light rail underneath it. And so in the council chambers were standing room only last night for that item. And again, I love that passion. I love that people take the time to fill up our inboxes with emails about why it wouldn't be a good idea. And so the council said, no, we're going to leave the rail trail alone.
That is off the table, at least for now.
It is. Because they're, you know, first of all, the community sentiment is don't touch it. But, you know, at the end of that part of the conversation, I did bring up, I'm extremely concerned about safety on the rail trail. And I have spoken about it before. A few years ago, our trails team did a survey, had a study done, another study done, with some suggestions on what could be done to improve the rail trail and improve safety on it. So with the council's support, we've asked staff to come back, just blow the dust off of that, and let's take another look at it and see if there's something else we can be doing.
And this would be about traffic, use of the current rail trail, you know, pedestrian and bicycle, and how to maybe do a little bit better job of managing safety on that trail. Because one of the things, and this is part of the bigger problem, is you see, I sound like an old guy. Young people not wearing helmets, riding e-bikes, going very fast.
Yes.
And it's a little scary.
It's very scary. You know, and we have so many visitors in town that are riding an e-bike for the very first time. And, you know, they've rented it for the day and they're going to ride it on the rail trail, but they don't know what they're doing. And there's moms pushing strollers, there's dad holding the hands of toddlers, and, you know, and people running and people doing whatever else. And the interface there, I have seen so many near misses, and it scares me to death. And so I'd like to look at it again.
Now, I want to just to go back briefly to the transit issue on the rail trail. I gather that there was an extremely strong reaction within Prospector. Do you have a sense of what community sentiment was outside of those who are talking about their very neighborhood? In other words, to what extent could this be looked at as partially a NIMBY issue?
I don't think that it is. You know, in talking with people from other parts of town that use the rail trail, I mean, most of our residents are on that rail trail, if not on a regular basis, at least periodically, and they value it. It's a community asset. It's part of the fabric of who we are, you know, and it supports our outdoor lifestyle, and it supports wildlife and everything that we're about as a community. And so to put motorized vehicles on there just didn't make sense.
Okay. Let's talk about what might make sense and some of the sort of options that you're going to look at going forward.
So staff is still going to be looking at a BRT for 248.
Without widening it, just do the existing? Mm-hmm. Okay.
They think that can happen. But again, we're now moving into phase two of the feasibility screening. So this was kind of the completion of phase one, narrowing it, and now narrowing it some more. Does it make sense to put flex lanes on 248s? You know, there's a conversation, should the flex lanes just be for buses, or should they be for vehicles as well? So, you know, lots still to explore, lots of feasibility to do, but we're narrowing it. We're narrowing the scope and looking at, you know, with an eye towards what do we want for our future and what can we accomplish by 2034 to help us get to our end goal here.
Talk a little bit about some of the complexities associated with flex lanes, because at a superficial level, it seems, wow, that seems pretty easy. You put up some lights.
Yeah.
But it's not that easy, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, we're on a narrow corridor like we have. How does that work, and how do we do that? Are they ingress only, or are they both ingress and egress? Are they only egress? And it depends on whether you're a skier trying to get out of town in the afternoon, thinking that we need, you know, flex lanes for egress, or if you're a commuter coming into town in the morning, you definitely think that you need flex lanes coming in. So, again, lots to be explored, and I'm excited that we're moving forward.
Okay, so we have bus rapid transit, we have flex lanes. Any other potential measures on the table at this point?
Those are the main ones.
Those are the main ones.
Right now.
And, you know, I always ask you these kinds of questions, timeline. We're moving into the next phase. How long do we think that'll take, and when could we see maybe some experimental implementation of some of these kinds of things?
You know, I think that the staff is going to do a check-in halfway through phase two with the council and just say, you know, this is kind of what we're coming up. Is this still the direction that we want to be going, or should we be looking at something else? And, you know, we certainly want to have things in place by 2034 when we welcome the world again, but we don't want to do something just for 2034. We want to say this makes sense for our community. This is what we want coming in on our roadways and how we might be able to affect traffic. There's no silver bullet. Everyone recognizes that. So is this going to help with the traffic? And, you know, another item on the agenda was park and rides, and I'm probably getting ahead here of what we wanted to talk about.
Oh, no.
But that's a very important part of it.
That was my next question, actually, because it all does seem to go together. And you mentioned 2034. I mean, I would hope that some of these things we'd be experimenting with well before that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So they're in place. Yeah.
Okay. Again, optimistically, could we see some experiments, some implementing some of these things as early as 2 years from now?
That's a great question, and that's not something we talked about. We didn't get a timeline.
You didn't
last
get
night.
That yet. Okay, mentioned park and rides.
Yeah.
Still a lot of vibrant discussion about that. Lots of people, I think, believe that at the end of the day, that's the only thing that might actually work.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about where we're going with that right now. What's going on?
Well, the staff has done a lot of work on them, and there was a countywide park and ride study done by Summit County in conjunction with the city. And the recommended places on 248 were either Richardson Flat where we already have a park and ride that's seen amazing utilization. And then we also, the Gordo parcel has been under discussion for years. The 248, when we first stood it up and made it a park and ride, there were more people that were skeptical that it would work than people that believed that it would work, including council members. And it has just been a wonderful success as it's grown. People become familiar with it. It has, now that we have direct routes to the resorts, it's gotten increasingly more popular for ridership. One thing we talked about is park and rides only work as well as the transportation that gets you where you want to go from there. So frequency, reliability is key for it. And, you know, last year we had 15-minute headways, and that helped some. But again, once you get on that bus, we want to make sure that you can get into town faster than if you were sitting there in your car. And I mean, many times as I've had to come in on 248 in the morning from some meeting I had out at Quinn's Junction, I'm always sitting there and the bus flies by me and I'm like, wow, I should have figured out how to get there on the bus. So.
Yeah, I think Richardson Flat, it's a remarkable success story. Yeah. And one that I at least didn't see coming with the kind of vibrancy that it's done. And that I guess that is something that you want to take into account in terms of evaluating where to go. It's not if you build it, they will come. It's if you make it easy and faster,
yes,
they will come.
Exactly.
And that's what's been done. So I think what does Gordo bring? Why is Gordo an attractive alternative?
I've always been a fan of Gordo. And, you know, said that again last night. In fact, I mentioned that I was sorry I didn't have a vote. there's been several times I'm like, why did I give my vote up? I think that they did an analysis in terms of the number of stalls. We own the land. Mm-hmm. We have access to it. It's easy access. It's closer to town than Richardson Flat. It's more intuitive for people to get to. You know, it always amazes me when I'm see signs, you know, Deer Valley parking is full, go to Richardson Flat. Well, if you're not from here, you don't know where that is.
What's that? Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think Gordo is a little more intuitive for mm-hmm. folks. It does bring people in on the 248 corridor, but it's early on in that corridor, and it keeps cars out of the choke point.
And again, I'm visualizing, I go under 40, where would the turnoff into Gordo be?
Right across at the stoplight. If you were to turn left coming from 40, mm-hmm. you would go onto Richardson Flat Road towards Park City Heights.
Right.
And if you turn right.
Right, you go onto Gordo.
That's Gordo. It's okay. Right there. And, you know, in terms of getting...
And that is a big choke point.
It is. And getting utilities there is much more cost efficient and easy than getting them out onto Richardson Flat. So there's, you know, there's challenges with both. One of the selling points for me for Gordo is it might help with school traffic. Because
oh, that's
in talking with some of the folks at the school district, there is interest in letting parents, instead of coming all the way into the Kearns campus to drop off their kids, they can drop them, we could do a drop and load onto a school bus from the Gordo lot. So parents, you know, could drop there and head out and not bring their cars into town.
Okay. I want to get to Matt Dias, but first, quickly, let's touch on where things stand with Recycle Utah.
Sure. Yesterday morning, Bill Sirocco, who is our liaison from the council to Recycle Utah, and I met with leadership from Summit County and as well as leadership from Recycle Utah. A couple of their board members and their executive director and some staff were there as well. And, you know, talked about what are the next steps. The county has been working really hard on an interim plan for recycling. And our staff has been very involved with that, which would involve kind of spokes where there would be more neighborhood drop-off places where people could drop off their cardboard and their glass. And you know, we laughed about some of the neighborhoods we'd have to add extra glass containers for the wine bottles. But that would be extremely convenient for our residents. It would keep people from Jeremy Ranch and Pine Brook from having to drive in, fight the traffic on 224 to come in to do their recycling. So that plan has not yet been unveiled, but it's underway. I get calls, you know, I got a call or email from a mom really worried that she'd have to tell her kids we could no longer recycle come June, and that's not the case. You know, the county's working really hard, the city's in there with them. We're still talking about the Gilmore parcel mm-hmm. and how that might best be fit into the overall plans. But, you know, talks are ongoing with all three.
Do we have a drop-dead date? Is the drop-dead date still in place for the closing of the existing facility?
We have said to Recycle Utah that we really need to have them out by September 1st. And that's primarily because we need to be able to put the road in that was promised as part of the engine house and one of the conditions of approval, as well as we're about to underground power lines, which means they're going to have to do a whole lot of things with the substation. And so it would just really be a conflict to have Recycle Utah cars coming in while we have construction trucks and all of that. So,
okay. Lots of transitions coming. You're not going to be the mayor anymore. And we learned this week that Matt Dias is leaving. Talk a little bit about Matt's career and his legacy.
You know, Matt is just an incredibly talented guy. He's smart as they come. He has a really great background in Washington, D.C. He worked, you know, for a senator. He's worked for a mayor. He's worked for bigger municipalities. And Dana Williams, former Mayor Williams, came last night and said at the end of his tenure, he insisted the council take a risk on this young kid from Massachusetts. And Matt has not disappointed. He has did a great job as the deputy city manager. And then when we had an opening, I was on the council at the time, we were just all so impressed with him. There really wasn't much thought. He needs to be the one to move up. And he has stepped into that role and filled it beautifully.
And so last time it was kind of easy because you had a AAA player sitting on the bench.
Yeah.
I think this time it might be a little more complicated. Am I right?
I think so. We have two great deputy city managers in place, but each of them have been here 3 months.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, they are coming up to speed really fast, drinking from a fire hose and doing, you know, great things with staff and really focusing on what their specific roles are. So that we will be appointing an interim city manager, and according to our code, Matt Dias and I will be making the interim appointment. Mm-hmm. And then it's still to be determined how we go about the recruitment. And, I mean, we've only had a couple days here. Our HR director is hard at work figuring out what the best way to do the recruitment is. According to our code, it either has to be appointed before November 4th or not until after the new mayor takes office. I have no intention of appointing before the new mayor takes office. Personally think that's really important, that the new mayor has a say in who they are going to be working with. It has to be a really special chemistry between the city manager and the mayor, because I can probably count on one hand the number of days in the last 4 years Matt and I haven't either spoken or texted or emailed back and forth. And, you know, you need that kind of a working relationship, and I certainly wouldn't presume to make that selection for the future mayor.
So the headline here is that we're going to have an interim until at least January.
Correct.
Okay. Mayor Nan, anything else you want to add before we go?
I just want to wish the Song Summit great success this weekend. I'm excited to have them in town. And, you know, we did groundbreaking, I guess you'd call it, at City Park yesterday for the new community building, and we had 50 campers out there with their hard hats on, and it was really fun. And I saw the Song Summit setting up, and I think we're going to have great energy in town.
It's the first time it's actually coming to town this year, isn't it?
It's a different format in town. I mean, before they were just kind of using existing venues. First time in City Park.
City Park, yeah. Exactly. Okay, Mayor Nan Worrell, thanks for stopping by this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Wahali is a gated golf community in Colville. As planned, the community would include a golf course, some 434 home sites, and some 303 semi-custom residences. But Wahali has been plagued with troubles of late. First, there were a series of lawsuits, and then the developer filed for bankruptcy on August the 8th. So what is this likely to mean for the development, and how will the bankruptcy process work? Here to help us understand how this is likely to play out, or how it may play out, is bankruptcy expert Tom Beckett of the firm Parsons, Bailey & Latimer. Parsons, Bailey is a financial supporter of KPCW. Tom, thanks for joining us this morning.
How are you? Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, sir. So let's start with the basics. What is the basic nature of this filing, and what are its immediate effects?
The filing is made under Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code, which means that the debtor, Wahali, intends to continue operations Now, we know its operations have been curtailed because of a shortfall in cash, but I think what Chapter 11 means for them is that they want to maintain the property in good shape and probably sell it.
And so right now, as you mentioned, from what we can gather from the public filings, there have been these lawsuits, there's been a shortage of cash. Will they try to, how do they finance ongoing operations, or how does a debtor typically finance ongoing operations in a situation like this?
Complicated question. Let me approach it in two steps. First of all, it probably has cash in a bank account someplace. It's truly in the case to know those details. And it probably has income, although it's too early to know those details. And it probably also has secured creditors. The secured creditor that had a security interest in the debtor's bank accounts is entitled to say, and one of them has already said, no, 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 you can't use any of that money in your bank account or income. It's what they call cash collateral. That's our collateral. No, thank you. You can't spend it. So that's an immediate problem. The debtor would have to go to the bankruptcy judge and say, oh, come on, they're adequately protected. They'll be fine. Let us use a little of their money, or take them out, bring in a new lender who consents to the use of cash collateral. So the scramble right now is before finding a debtor, finding a purchaser, they're going to be looking for a lender.
And is that typically what would happen in a situation like this? Because you've got, it sounds like you've got some creditors who have some pretty significant debts against the property and are unlikely to sort of allow their debts to get substantially, or are likely to object to a substantial reduction in that debt that would allow the current ownership to keep it.
Correct. And let's look at the most important two classes of debt, which are secured, which are really, really important, and unsecured, which are not going to be all that important for the time being. Unsecured creditors are not going to be paid until secured creditors are paid. And as you noted, there have been a number of lawsuits by unsecured creditors. Those lawsuits now go on hold, and we see what happens with the bankruptcy case.
In a situation like this, could we see the secured creditors actually take over the ownership of the institution? Does that sometimes happen?
That's the eventuality. What happens is the secured creditor will go to the bankruptcy court and say, allow us to foreclose. And then the bankruptcy court can say yes or no. Now, in a case like this, where the debtor is a single asset real estate company, Congress gives a little bit of an advantage to the creditors of a single asset real estate company because they don't like projects like this, you know, pushing it and pushing it and pushing it and then filing bankruptcy. So it's a pretty short time fuse. And so the resort is going to have to contend with the secured lender seeking relief from stay. And the bankruptcy court will probably say, I'll do that unless you fix things like Tootsuite. And then when the creditor forecloses, then they will put it up for sale.
And again, in a situation like this, and recognizing that of all the hundreds of bankruptcies you've been through, none of them is typical, how long could we expect that process to take?
We're going to know within 45 days where this is going, maybe 30 days, one or two court hearings. The whole process for something like this shouldn't be more than 120 days.
Now, it may well be that some of the people listening to this today have bought lots in Wahali and are probably a little insecure about what's likely to happen. Talk to us a little bit about how things will typically play out like this, in a bankruptcy like this, for a lot owner who bought a membership with a promise of a certain level of amenities. And those promises are now, I guess, like every other, quote, dead, unquote, under hold.
Yep. Yeah, they're just promises at this point. So, you know, this turns on exactly what the documents say. And so it's really hard to make overall, you know, guesses. But I've done a number of these resort bankruptcies. And to my understanding, what's typical is that when you buy a membership, you promised to build. Now, I don't know how far you have to go down that process of buying and building to become a member. I would expect it's just an undertaking. You're going to buy and build. And so you make a membership deposit. That money is now, I suspect, gone. Let's just say it's you have an unsecured claim. You're not going to get that money back until the secured lenders get paid. Now, if you've bought a lot on the property, I think you own a lot adjacent to a golf course that doesn't have a clubhouse or running water. So, you know, I would expect that somebody who's bought property owns that property, and it's probably not what they expected. Now, I do need to say something, and I do need to make sure that your listeners are aware of this, Roger. Just today, a lawyer made an appearance in this bankruptcy case on behalf of concerned owners. And I don't know who the concerned owners are, but I'll bet you they're people who have bought property. Mm-hmm. Or people who think that they're members of a club. The lawyer's name is David Billings. He's very good. He's at Fabian Vancott in Salt Lake City. And I encourage anybody who's got specific questions about this bankruptcy and their lot, David Billings is going to be the go-to person in this case.
As a practical matter, whoever buys this, I would assume, is going to want to market it in a fashion similar to what the original owners wanted to do, as a gated community with lots of amenities, including a golf course. Does that make it likely that the lot owners who've already bought membership are probably going to get something close to what they wanted? Or is that what we've seen in other kinds of these other bankruptcies of this type?
For the most part, yes. And certainly that's what they want to happen, and that's what we all want for them to happen. There have been resorts that have tipped into Chapter 7, and you have golf courses overgrown with moss, and I don't want to be a pessimist, but it can happen.
Okay. But again, I would you'd think the way to maximize the value of the asset would be to go forward, but who knows, right? You and I sitting here don't know.
Right. It's hard to imagine a higher and better use for what looks like a really nice golf course. Yeah. Right, that's built and being maintained. It just needs somebody to come in and put in the money for the infrastructure and for the clubhouse and for the village and for the shops and for everything that's going to attract people then to purchase memberships. Only if someone concluded that the net present value of that is less than a dollar would they not bid at least a dollar.
Okay. Anything else our listeners should to know to try to understand this better?
Call David Billings.
if you're a property owner, call David Billings.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Because it looks like he's assembled a group, and the larger the group, the more influence they will have, and the more detailed knowledge he'll have about the case.
So will they like be an? I know that typically in a Chapter 11, there's something called a creditors committee. Will this be like an adjunct to the creditors committee, or will he be like a representative on the creditors committee? How will that typically happen?
That's a really good question. And I was involved in a bankruptcy up in Montana, the Yellowstone Club, where I represented the unsecured creditors committee. And in the beginning, the unsecured creditors committee were just a bunch of typical unsecured creditors. Right. You know, they supplied the flowers for the ballroom and so forth. And pretty soon all the members showed up and wanted to be on the committee, and it ended up representing the interests of the members. And so I don't think people who own lots are going to qualify to be on the creditors committee, but members are going to be on the creditors committee. If there is a creditors committee, they will have to tailor an approach which includes their interests. The lot owners then are either going to be an ad hoc group. They just show up in the bankruptcy and they're filing amicus briefs. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the court may want to make the lot owners, if there are enough of them, an official committee. The court can make as many official committees as she wants.
Okay, Tom Beckett of Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, thanks for spending time with us. I suspect I'll be calling you on you again when we have another bankruptcy in the news here at KPCW.
And I'll look forward to it.
All right,
nice
thanks,
to
Tom.
See you. Thanks, Roger.
Bye-bye. The leading candidates in the Park City Council primary election each performed well in precincts all across town. Unofficial results released so far show. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has this breakdown.
In Park Meadows, where over 2,000 votes were cast, Tana Tully led the way with 21% of the vote, followed by Diego Zagara with 20%. Jeremy Rubel, Beth Armstrong, John Kenworthy, and Danny Glasser each had around 11% of votes in the neighborhood, which had the largest voting pool in the primary election. Tully led again in Deer Valley with 19% of votes. Rubel was close behind at 17%, followed by Zagara with 16%. Kenworthy collected 13% ahead of Glasser and Armstrong, who each had around 10%. Tully also performed strongly in Prospector with nearly 30% of votes. Zagara was second there with 20%. Molly Miller outperformed in her home neighborhood, earning over 17% of votes. Every other candidate had less than 10% in Prospector. In Thanes, Tully led with 19% of votes, with Rubel finishing just behind with over 18%. Zagara won 17% there, followed by Armstrong with 14%. Tully was only bested in Old Town, where she got 21% of votes to Zagara's 24%. Rubel and Kenworthy each got 14% of votes. Based on the unofficial vote count released so far, Tully, Zagara, Rubel, and Kenworthy will advance to the general election, where Parkites will elect two council members and a mayor. A primary wasn't necessary for the mayoral race because there are only two candidates, Ryan Dickey and Jack Rubin. Park City recorder Michelle Kellogg said there are 22 outstanding ballots that require signature verification. Additional results will likely not be released until the official canvass on August 26th. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.